Magic formula for success of having an innovation program is having a proselyte or champion and having C-suite buy-in. So it starts with that. If you don't have one or the other, if you have one or the other, you're still not there. Got to have both. That's the catalytic element that makes enterprise innovation work. The other is don't fall into the mistake of sequestering or making that available only to those who have an MD or a PhD or an MBA. Everybody.
If you want to drastically improve your business, learn proven growth strategies, and generate sustained results for your organization, you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Innovation Junkies Podcast.
Is your growth plan missing the mark? Take advantage of our strategic growth diagnostic from Innovation Junkie. Growth DX helps you benchmark your company and leadership team with a set of best practices across six critical pillars of every successful growth plan. Visit innovationjunkie.com/growthdx to learn more. Now, on to the episode.
Hey guys, Jeff Standards here. Welcome to another episode of the Innovation Junkies Podcast. I'm here with my partner, Jeff Amerine. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing great. Happy to be on today. I'm looking forward to this episode.
Yeah, I am as well. Let's just hop right into it. How about we do that?
Sounds great.
So today we are honored and it's our pleasure to have Dr. Thomas Graham with us. He's world renowned for his work in orthopedic hand surgery. He's a healthcare executive. He's a best-selling author, inventor, and entrepreneur. Most recently, Dr. Graham joined Kettering Health in Dayton, Ohio in spring of 2021, where he now serves as their senior vice president and their inaugural chief innovation and transformation officer. He leads the Charles F. Kettering Innovations, which is the health system's technology transfer and entrepreneurship arm. We are so honored to have you with us today, Dr. Graham, and we look forward to the conversation.
Appreciate that greatly.
Absolutely.
So, hey, Jeff, before we launch into the really topical matters, we like to have a sort of silly random musing at the beginning of every episode. And today we thought it would be interesting to find out what everybody's favorite sitcom is. So Dr. Graham, what's your favorite sitcom? If you have one, and it's okay to say, you know, you hate sitcoms, I guess.
No. I love entertainment of all types. You know, honestly, I love Gilligan's Island. I thought it was like, what, those people got to be able to get off of that island. Yeah. And just the way that they constructed the cast and represented so many, you know, viewpoints and perspectives and socioeconomic issues. I always got a kick out of that. Plus, I had a crush on Marianne.
That's good. Jeff, what about you?
You know, I have to say, I was going to go the Gilligan's route too, because I'm kind of a Gilligan, you know, and I was going to go that route. But I'll have to say, I'll go a little more recent since Dr. Graham stole my thunder on Gilligan. But I got to say, The Big Bang Theory. You know, I just fell in love with The Big Bang Theory because you have all these scientists living together. You know, they don't have a social life. The writing behind it was absolutely some of the most clever writing that I've ever seen. So in days past, Gilligan's Island, but in the present tense or not so distant past was Big Bang Theory.
Well, so I'll take liberties of going old, not quite as old, and recent. So my old favorite is Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh yeah,
I'm a big Jethro Bodine fan. I guess. Blade. And that was kind of the same vintage as Gilligan's Island, which I watched regularly. The medium range in the past 25 years would probably be Seinfeld. I thought that some of the humor in Seinfeld was pretty spectacularly good. Things like the soup Nazi and Kramer. And then more recently, and maybe more topical, I really thought that Silicon Valley that was on HBO was pretty hilarious. And some of those things which were intended to be situational comedy were a little true to life based on some of the experiences I've had. So those were, I took some liberties, but those were mine.
You know, they just don't make them like Gilligan's Island, Beverly Hillbillies, yeah, Andy Griffith, you know, yeah, some of those kinds of things. So yeah, no, I was a big Don Knotts fan too.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, how about we hop in it? So, Dr. Graham, you most recently moved over to Kettering from Cleveland Clinic, where you pioneered Cleveland Clinic's transformation or technology transfer and innovation function there. And so I'd like to maybe start today by talking a little bit about just the concept that you refer to as mission-driven innovation. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how you see that? And we'll transition kind of into how that plays into healthcare.
Sure. You know, it's always difficult to define innovation, isn't it? It's one of the most sought after individual and corporate characteristics, but people struggle with the ability to wrap their mind around it. And right now, if you drive down the road, you'll see innovation on every billboard or switch on the TV. It's discussed on every commercial, it seems. You know, for us, it's just leveraging your creative culture to improve and extend human life and create economic opportunity for individuals, institutions, and the communities we serve. We think that's very well aligned with our mission, right? Mm. Most hospital or healthcare system missions are similar, and they should be. Care for the sick, investigate their problems, train future leaders, right? Mm-hmm. We think that being at the vanguard of solving the unmet need is just as relevant to what we do on a daily basis. And that really sums it up. I hope that translates or is translatable, scalable to every organization who wishes to get into the real practice of innovation.
And as a follow-up, I'd really be curious about your thoughts. We tend to sometimes think of healthcare as being reactionary. It's reactive to indications. What are your thoughts about the direction that healthcare innovation is going as it relates to prevention or early intervention? Where talk to us a little bit about what you see happening in that regard.
It's just as much in the portfolio as, right, catching up with the latest cancer drug or device. I think as we're able to imbibe and metabolize data better, not just on the episodic manner that we've done it, just like we've rendered care on an episodic manner, now that we have an ability to look more holistically at the individual or larger communities, I think we now have the luxury and potentially the responsibility of looking at the full spectrum of care, which goes from functional wellness, maybe nutrition and everything else that goes with that wellness imprimatur, sleep, stress management, et cetera, all the way through acute and chronic management of injuries and disorders through actual performance, enhancing performance. So I think that we now have opened the aperture and not looked at what changes can I make to this hunk of metal that I stick into somebody in the operating room, mm-hmm. and changed it dramatically. And I think prevention, both on the individual and the community level, is the result of that. And then you sprinkle in a little precision medicine, and that's another whole topic. But I think now we understand that the power of both the delivery and the digital components can come together and make us more effective at what I call strategic innovation.
You know, I heard you say in one of your online talks, I think it was Singularity, where you said that at Cleveland Clinic, you guys had somewhere in the neighborhood of 700 royalty producing agreements in place or inventions in place. Whether it's there or now at Kettering, what proportion, just, I don't know, kind of guesstimate, I guess, what proportion are you seeing of more digital health types of solutions coming to the forefront versus traditional device inventions and what have you?
Great question. You know, way back when, you know, innovation began with a small I and nobody really knew what you were talking about, when we kind of put together yeah, I think I was the inaugural chief innovation officer in all of healthcare back in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. Our portfolio has always been the 4 Ds: drug, device, digital, and delivery. And right now, mm-hmm. the last two go together. 2/3 to 3/4 of our portfolio is device. You know, maybe you're an institution that has medicinal chemistry, drug development, and that can be kind mm-hmm. of put off in a little bit different, because I think, as we all know, that pathway is very long. And a little different. So let's just put an asterisk by that a second. Mm-hmm. It's completely flipped now. You know, two and a half decades ahead of this now, where really everything's digital. You know, every darn pill probably has a digital component to it, as do, right. You know, devices that have a capability of giving information. So I don't think there's any doubt that there's still a role for shiny metal objects. And that's how I got into it. That's how we started Cleveland Clinic Innovations. That's how most organizations who are starting to move into innovation find themselves, that latent innovation that happens when you start a program where you go from 0 to 60 in no time. You gave an example. I have a couple also. Often start with those hard assets. Yet to tell you the truth, and I now I'm sounding like I'm repeating myself, the way that we manage, analyze, and act on the ones and zeros is really what is driving a great deal of the innovation now.
Yeah.
You know, as you look at some of the things that are being discussed as it relates to social determinants of health, I mean, I think that speaks to that idea of understanding some of the other factors that lead to things like metabolic syndrome and diabetes and all these sort of chronic issues that plague many parts of the population now. Where do you see that going? That speaks to the digital side of that, but what are the possibilities there?
Remember a couple of minutes ago, we were just talking about, you know, intaking data, analyzing. I think the quantified self is going to move from just a few of us wearing, you know, step trackers, you know, to actual getting the information that reflects a person's life and health, and then being able to make that personal and actionable. Where we have a relationship with that data, we might be gleaning whether it is from something worn, something implantable, something in the home. I think that's probably where a great deal of advancement is going to take place. You know, now it's a little bit of esoterica. You know, wow, we scanned everything you put in your refrigerator, so we know what's in there, so we know what you can make, and we know it's caloric intake, and we know you're diabetic, and kind of going on from there to make it a little bit more concrete and actionable. So that may sound overly broad, but I think taking the next step in maturation and discipline in the quantified self and turning it into actionable prevention, maintenance, treatment, type of algorithms and things we can deliver.
Shifting gears a little bit, I'd love to get your perspective on scientists and researchers becoming innovators, because there's a difference there, right? And commercializable innovators. You know, we've having worked a lot with medical researchers, they are the experts and have been the experts in their entire careers. And then when they develop an invention or a potential idea or a potential invention, they have innovation folks like us saying, well, let's do some customer discovery. Let's really get out there and understand from the end users and from the economic decision makers and how big is the problem we're solving, and is it big enough that it would warrant a profitable ongoing concern if it were to be commercialized. Have you had that experience? And if so, how have you overcome that within changing the culture of a research institution to that of an innovative commercialization engine, so to speak?
Yeah, you've really packed a lot into really the discussion of research with development, not research and development, right?
Right, right.
What I think you're getting toward is I've long tried to, first of all, let's understand that I am so proud of our academic medical centers and research universities and how they remain on the frontier of identifying unmet needs. What we advance with the work that's being done at the bedside and laboratory bench. Many people, let's say in the venture community, think these things are born on third base. Those of us who've dedicated our careers to innovation and what I call organic innovation have entertained all these folks who walk in and say, I'm an early stage investor. And when you tell them what you really do, they can't wait to run out the door. They don't understand what it takes to go from a napkin idea to first in man. Okay.
Exactly.
Let's start there. But what you're really highlighting, I think, is the difference between the clinical driven innovation and, let's say, the research driven innovation. I've always talked about the virtuous cycle. Problem identified at the bedside. Wow, that's the third time that I've seen that implant fail exactly the same place. Let me put my mind to that. Let me go into my workshop, figure it out. It then takes a cycle of investment, divestment, prototyping, engineering, regulatory, all the beating up you do in the long peripatetic journey that we all know is innovation to be delivered back to the bedside. But the clinician has always known that they've had that relationship, let's say, with industry. They've been in a vendor-client relationship before. I think researchers sometimes subvert that because they're used to, I don't want to study something. Let's get a grant. Let's present and talk about it, which sometimes also threatens the actual patenting process. Let's talk about that. And then they just want to keep that going. And when you come over from the commercialization side, you're sometimes looked at as kind of almost sullying those individuals who are dedicated to the discovery science. I've spent a lot of my time trying to build those bridges, trying to have individuals understand both from an aspirational standpoint and a practical standpoint. Not bad to turn the lights on, keep the lights turned on, or pay for your graduate students, or buy a couple beakers. So I think introducing the academician, the discovery scientist, to the concept of commercialization, assisting them by having the innovation nucleus have individuals that speak their language, who are patrolling the corridors of the laboratory, not just passively rebounding ideas. You know, we have these situations like, hey, what are you working on? Jet fuel. Like, what's happening? Well, we figured out you can increase the efficiency of jet engines by 25%. Well, what are you doing with that? Well, who would want that? Like, it's just a research interest of mine. I picked something outside of healthcare as an exemplar. But the idea is innovation. Again, innovation isn't you can wear jeans on Friday and bring your dog to work and play Frisbee. It's a discipline that needs to be practiced. And when you put in the right infrastructure and architecture, when you put in the right processes, when you inform people, one and first, culturally, that their ideas are important, that their ideas have value. Everybody's an expert. I don't care whether you work on the loading dock or you are a doc, you probably have ways of improving what's going on at your organization. Once you build that lightning rod, which is an innovation capacity, all of a sudden people say, wait a minute, I'm not going to shove this in the drawer, throw it away, or you know, nobody cares what I think. That's the worst outcome imaginable. Dr. Brown has a great idea, but she doesn't have access to an innovation infrastructure. Like, she goes, forget about it. I'll just put it in the drawer. No patients are helped. The inventor doesn't benefit. The institution doesn't advance. Jobs aren't created. That was the whole idea. I grew up in Appalachia. I watched the steel industry and pottery industry disintegrate. And so I've dedicated a significant portion of my time to transition our state economy from an industrial base to a knowledge base. But you got to do it in a way that has that level of discipline. And it's a process-oriented, metrics-driven game. As you probably know, my clinical practice is dedicated to the care of professional athletes mostly. It ain't a game till you keep score. And you got to keep scoring innovation.
So are you finding as well that the showcasing of successful ideas breeds more ideas coming to the forefront? And so are you actively involved in showcasing some of those rock stars?
Well, listen, I'm not averse to a little theater, right? I love thought leadership forums, ideas festivals. I love programs that can be celebrated. We all can think of Shark Tank. Let me tell you something. I think it's the greatest thing because it's turned people on to entrepreneurship. And again, that idea that their creative thought is important. So yeah, we like to bring individuals from the outside and speak about it. We like to celebrate our own inventors and innovators. We like to reward them And by the way, recruitment, retention, and reward is another great benefit of having an innovation program. Like if an individual is trying to decide between this university and that hospital to go practice, and they believe that they're innovative, which I think probably everybody does. It's one of the few things, if you're told you're innovative, everybody smiles, that they'll come to your institution, but even though the weather's terrible. Right. And that's what that was kind of what we leveraged a lot here in the upper tier of the Midwest. So, it doesn't hurt when one person pulls in the garage and they're driving a Yugo, and one drives in a Cadillac and say, wait a minute, we have the same job. What's going on? Well, I invented some trinket and I have a benefit from it.
Yeah,
and, exactly. You know, I just think there's a lot of ways that innovation can insinuate itself in an organization. And the wins are not just monetary. They're not, you know, just counting the number of patents or royalty bearing license or spin out companies. There's a lot of enculturation that happens. And from that comes a lot of pride in the organization. And that pride is transferred to the communities we serve.
And sometimes, you know, Dr. Graham, and I'd be really interested in your thoughts on this. It's a long process to go from having sort of an island of a few innovators and then the rest of the organization focused on operational efficiency, kind of the day-to-day, do no harm, take care of the immediate needs, versus a culture of innovation where it's pervasive. And what you know, as you think about what advice you might give others that are early in that journey of really trying to get that cultural transformation towards building a lasting, sustainable culture of innovation that goes across the organization, what bits of advice would you give in that regard?
Yeah. The magic formula for success of having an innovation program is having a proselyter champion and having C-suite buy-in. So it starts with that. Mm-hmm. If you don't have one or the other, if you have one or the other, you're still not there. Got to have both. That's the catalytic element that makes enterprise innovation work. The other is don't fall into the mistake of sequestering or making that available only to those who have an MD or PhD or an MBA. Everybody. The Pareto principle operates 80-20. And if you only expose that process to the what you consider your top tier of potential innovators, you're going to reduce even further the output. Innovation, again, needs to be celebrated. The ward clerk's going to have a great idea. You know, you just have to be able to distribute that concept. And then the other is move from opportunistic innovation, the eureka, right? That's what everybody thinks of, I think, about innovation, to synergistic innovation, putting ideas together inside and outside your institution, even with potential competitors. Innovation is not a competitive platform. I can't steal ideas from somebody's head. And yes, I understand the USPTO, but collaborate even with that organization across town who you might be contributing for the next baby being born or next total knee being done. You can collaborate on innovation. But take it to that last step, which is the holy grail of innovation, which is strategic innovation. Innovate around something. Now, that might be something that you pull your organization, et cetera. It usually comes down into just a couple different domains. It's access, outcome, you might want to call that quality, patient experience, and then operational efficiency. If you asked one of the consultants, they'd have 188 different parameters. It comes down to those four things, because that's what you compete over on the other side. So when you do compete, you want to be optimizing those things. And your people, I guarantee it, have ideas on how to advance your organization toward improvement in one or more of those.
And when you talk about those four things around which to innovate, it's not relegated only to the research institutions. The community health center or the regional health system down the street could rally around those four things with their staff and an innovation program as well.
And might have a better laboratory. What do I mean by that? They are urban, suburban, and rural. They're a different socioeconomic bent. They have a different connectivity to their community. Keep going, right? And so on the community level, innovation ignites and translates into things like job growth, et cetera, when you have med and ed. So if you already have those things, you have a little bit of a head start, as we've shown in Pittsburgh, Cleveland, et cetera. Down here in Dayton, we add another one, Fed. We have, you know, 45,000 people working at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So we actually have a troika of things that I believe, and this is why I'm here, will redefine. You know, listen, Dayton was Silicon Valley last century. Mm-hmm. Period, end of report. Most patents per capita, you know, it's where Kettering and Patterson and Thomas Watson, all of them came out of Dayton. If you drove a car today, thank Dayton. If you flew in a plane last week, thank Dayton. If you drink a cold drink today, thank Dayton. And that's why I believe this is a perfect cauldron to rediscover it. And again, why I'm at an institution whose the name of Charles F. Kettering is right on the front, second only trying to think of who has the most patents, guys, help me out. Edison. In the number of patents, you know, he invented the electric starter, he invented Freon, you know, unbelievable what these folks did. And that's what motivates me. Again, can you translate it from the individual to the entire community and beyond? Mm-hmm. You know, the only net new job creator in our country the last 10 years are companies less than 5 years old.
That's right.
About half of those came out of healthcare. So let's just do the math. Mm-hmm. Right. This is how important the work you're doing and the individuals listening to this podcast are to our American economy. And you might guess I'm a bit of a patriot, right?
Hey, I love it.
And so the idea is there, you know, my dad, who was a industrialist, would say what's better. The only thing better is making American flags out of cotton. Is we're doing things that can improve the health of your loved ones, because there's only one. I'm an upbeat, optimistic guy. There's only one bummer. I got to tell you, everybody's going to be a patient one day. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was for 2 years. I was the sickest man on the face of the earth for 2 years. Mm-hmm. I was in the hospital, so I know it. So I'm not a dilettante. I'm the poster boy for innovation. It saved my life, and I've dedicated a significant part of my career for it. That's why we are helping other organizations. I have a meeting later on today with an organization from Atlanta who wants to stand up their innovation capacity. We started something called the Global Healthcare Innovation Alliance, where we helped other medical centers, research universities, government labs, and then ultimately commercial companies to innovate. People already figured out why we were helping Northwell or MedStar develop their innovation capacity. They thought it was kind of interesting that we helped Notre Dame. I said, Cleveland Clinic didn't have a football team. That's why I had to do that. NASA, you know, what's a better exemplar of innovation than thousands of people worried about two or three people in the harshest environment and miniaturization and performance of materials and things like that. And then they were kind of shocked that we partnered with Parker Hannifin. Some people know it, some people don't. They're a $14, $15 billion motion control giant, 400 or so parts in your car or your airplane. And people ask me why we, you know, how'd you figure that out? I said, well, we talked to them, number one. And second, like, what do you do? Well, probably nothing you'd be interested in. We flow fluid through tubes with valves in them. Oh, really? Just like our urologist and cardiologist think about every day? All of a sudden, you have a half a billion dollar medical device portfolio. You have to be prepared to ask the questions and understand how those answers fit in a bigger matrix that we're all building together. And that's what makes me proud. You know, we're one of the founding members of HIPS, Healthcare Innovators Professional Society. We finally started a professional society with the original 33 chief innovation officers. Give Toby Hamilton from Texas a lot of the credit of that, but now we can talk about it. You know, most of us are scabbed over, but not healed in yet. Innovation's hard. It's nonlinear, yes, long to success, fraught with failure. And like I said, if I hear one more time, too early, too risky. Yeah, I get that. Where do you think this stuff comes from? Yeah. So we now are sharing everything we can. I don't think, you know, that Roy Rosen at Penn or, you know, these folks are not, we're not competing. We're trying to help each other because I know I have a lock on my campus and somebody else may have the key. And if we don't open that ability to communicate and put things together and share not only the information, but the success, then we're going to go nowhere as an innovation ecosystem.
We could go on for hours and hours. We're talking with Dr. Thomas Graham, Chief Innovation and Transformation Officer at Kettering Health System. You will want to check out his book called Innovation, the Cleveland Clinic Way. Dr. Graham, where can they find that, and where can our listeners connect with you best?
It's available on Amazon, et cetera. My only claim to fame is I knocked the Shark Tank guy Draymond John off the bestseller list for 1 week.
That's pretty good.
That's good.
Bestseller list. I have a lot of respect for him, actually.
Yeah.
I'm at Kettering Health in Dayton. We're a dynamic, regional, growth-oriented system, 14 hospitals, 15, 16,000 employees. We're really proud of what we do as our collection of acute care hospitals form a high-performing network. We're the official healthcare provider of the Cincinnati Bengals. We're doing a lot of stuff right. And again, when you have a head start like that of having Charles Kettering's name on your building, you better do that. So we're really proud to be a faith-based, mission-driven, high innovation environment that again is celebrating our heritage both on an individual level, Charles Kettering, and on a regional level, representing Dayton, who, like I said, has been so important to this country's advancement of creative thought.
Well, it is a pleasure having you with us today, and it's certainly an honor as well. We thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks
really
for coming
appreciate
on.
It. Best of success to everybody. And I'm an easy guy to find. And like I said, innovation gets supercharged by partnership, and we're always open to that.
Fantastic.
Fantastic. This has been another episode of the Innovation Junkies podcast. Thank you for joining.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Feedback from listeners like you helps us create outstanding content. So if you like this episode, be sure to rate us or leave a review. Also, don't forget to subscribe to get the latest growth and innovation strategies. Thanks for tuning in to the Innovation Junkies podcast.